let me talk to you about popcorn kernels, lily bulbs, cake batter, and nice revelations. This Sunday is really the second Sunday of Easter in the church calendar, but I leave it to Pastor Pete to tell you what that means to us. And go on with a different story. My thoughts were turned in another direction a few weeks when I read in the Brethren Newsline an item that talked about the ministry and mission board's planning for the next 10 years. And I was, what I did not read, concerned me so much that I sent an email to Brother Ben Barlow, who sits on my board. And as I prepared today, that recent experience turned my thoughts in a slightly different direction. I thought that maybe looking at some of life experience and at M.R. Ziegler and the Brethren Service Commission, we might learn a little bit about how to envision the future. You know, there's an old saying that says, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you. I think you could also say that if you don't know where you're coming from, you don't really know whether you're going around in circles or not. So those are some of my thoughts as I was preparing for today. We recently came through a period of this church year that was called the Epiphany. Now, that sounds like a more interesting word to me. There are two different dictionary definitions of Epiphany. One is a sudden manifestation of the essence or meaning of something. Another says a comprehension or perception of reality by means of sudden intuitive realization. As I reflected on life, I was reminded of some of my own life epiphanies, and I want to share some of that with you. First, a word about the title of my talk. I believe that understanding comes to us in different ways and different speeds. Popcorn experiences turn things inside out and very suddenly. You can't miss the epiphanies. You know the very instant they happen. Lily bulb revelations are different. When planted in the right place and in their own season, lilies manifest themselves in beauty and aroma. And though slow in time, it is no less a marvelous revelation. And cake batter, in the presence of heat, turns from liquid to a delightful taste experience. Similarly, life experiences speak to us in different ways and at different speed. Unfortunately, too often in our anticipation of the expected results, we miss obvious truths that virtually stare us in the face. I've come to appreciate that my own learning often comes intuitively, but very seldom is it sudden. I guess that makes me a slow learner. In our learning about life, I would suggest that we rarely stick with slow, step-by-step logic. Learning has an emotional component to it, and unless thinking and learning are in sync, we don't make that part of our guide for living life. From time to time, I sense that though we are a small congregation, we really may not know very much about one another. In conversation with some of you here at church, I've discovered some really significant things that you have done or did in your lives, but because of personal modesty, they remain hidden. We all have life stories. I believe that in the context of a church congregation, the fellowship is strengthened as we know of each other's stories. So here's a little bit of my story. My life has had a special connection to the Church of the Brethren. Until I graduated from high school, I attended two congregations in Ludlow County, Pennsylvania. And then the next third of my life was tied to Brethren-related programs, including Elizabethtown College, Brethren Volunteer Service in Europe, the National Service Board for Religious Objectives in Washington, D.C., the Health Project in Italy, where we had the cowbells, but the sheepbell, I mean, and Castanier Hospital in Puerto Rico. Earlier, we learned a little bit about the man, M.R. Ziegler. My life, like many others, followed trails that he had blazed. Nearly 25 years of my life fell within the arc of the activities that he had set in motion. So that's the kind of person he was. Before going further, I need to acknowledge that this journey would not have happened had it not been for an equal partnership and commitment on the part of my wife, Carolyn. He made a home for us and eventually five children in Sardinia, Italy, in Castanier, Puerto Rico, in Zakabat, Bangladesh, and Quito, Ecuador. Across 4 years in Bangladesh, she homeschooled three of our children. And while we call Perth Amboy New Jersey home, she faced many challenges across 7 years as I made perhaps a dozen trips, month-long trips to Asia. For our children, it is not easy, an easy transition to come to the USA and start the college education, or in the case of three younger children, to enter the strange world of US high schools. As I composed my email to Ben Barlow, I reflected on how much, or how little, rather, younger members of our church know about that past era of the Church of the Brethren. Brethren historian Don Durnbaugh called it a remarkable explosion of Brethren service activity, and notes that the creativity, energy, and daring of the leaders of the movement were made possible by the staunch support and sacrifice of the membership of the Church of the Brethren. I think Don Durnbaugh chose all of those words very carefully. I think they were meaningful in describing what we're talking about. I realized that what to me was a personal experience, to many of you is distant, almost ancient history. So as it came to speak today emerged, I thought this might be an appropriate time to share from personal experience. My own first memory of M.R. Ziegler was when he was reporting to a district meeting in eastern Pennsylvania about a recent trip that he had made to Europe, in which he described all the devastation and the needs of the people of Europe and things that the brethren might be able to do. And after he finished his report to that meeting, they called for a second offering, and if my memory serves me correctly, they raised about $5,000, which at that time, back in the late 40s, was a sizable sum of money for a church gathering to raise. About that time, he also recruited about a score of young brethren, some of them husbands and wives, who went and served in Europe with the Christian agencies. And then after volunteer service was authorized in 1948, there were almost three decades in which every year, about 15 to 20 young people who were on their way were in Europe with a commitment of 2 years to serve in the needs of the in the program of the Brethren Service Commission there in Europe. They worked with refugees, with handicapped, in church social work agencies, in retirement homes, in orphanages. They provided material aid. They followed up on donated heifers. They organized international summer work camps. They rebuilt a large Protestant school in Vienna and a hotel nearby Vienna. And they revived an irrigation system in northern Greece, which had been abandoned for centuries. In fact, they worked almost everywhere that there was some sort of human need that American volunteers could meet. And M.R. Ziegler learned to know the volunteers individually. And in fact, he probably already knew their parents because he traveled so widely among the brothers before that. And he motivated the youth to do good work, and they helped them to understand what it was that they were doing with their lives and their time there. With a cumulative record of hundreds of years of VBS service to church agencies and institutions of Europe, M.R. Ziegler was really not scoffed at by people in the Royal Council when he asked that question, when will Christians stop killing each other? And he did it repeatedly, and he meant it, and he understood what he meant. But that witness and the witness of the volunteers across those three decades and MR's successors brought the World Council to a position where they seriously considered issues of war and peace as part of their agenda. But tragedy befell M.R. Ziegler at the time of his planned retirement, which was following the celebration of the 250th anniversary of the Church of the Brethren, which was occasion was in August of 1958. On a trip to Sweden, he failed to keep his car on the left-hand side of the road after leaving Denmark. One country's right-hand drive, one village side left-hand drive. A head-on collision with another vehicle occurred. His wife, Amy, died before he arrived. After his own recovery, M.R. Ziegler tried retirement in Florida, but he got tired of it. He soon set about hobnobbing with youth and organizing Brother Peace Seekers into On Earth Peace, which is still a continuing peace witness within the Church of the Brethren. He died in October 1985, just a few weeks short of his 94th birthday. M.R. Ziegler, in two decades before his retirement, set a pace and achieved program output that was amazing. So how does a church do when a career like that ends? Well, the truth is, not very well. There were bumps in the road, as other people try to assume leadership and do things in his manner, and we really missed it. But I share this account of M.R. Ziegler because of how central he was to the life of the church during those several decades. Of course, as a company manager, M.R. Ziegler recruited numerous other brethren to help to oversee the flurry of activity. To list any would be to miss many more, so I'll not attempt that. But a book in our church library called A Cup of Cold Water by Kenneth Kreider tells all the names and gives all the details that the story bears. So maybe the library people can put that out so people can look at it. But let me tell you a bit more about what was going on in my own head across these years. Within 6 months after my graduation from Elizabethtown College, I find myself in an unplanned journey to Germany. I just landed in Bremerhaven, Germany with cattle and everything. Our college motto was educate for service, but after I left college, I was really looking for a job as a chemist to help to pay for my college loan. Only when my draft board sent me that special letter did I decide to join Brethren Volunteer Service. And though I valued the fact that the Church of the Brethren was called a peace church and was registered as a conscientious objector, I had little idea about what a peace seeker, peacemaker needed to do in an era of post-war destruction or a fully launched Cold War. I was mostly looking to get the draft monkey off my back. But as I returned from Europe 4 years later, I truly felt part of a community that was committed to doing acts that make for peace. I was not simply content that my church was called one of the peace churches. I felt the need for peacemaking to be a part of my life agenda. I could talk at length about jobs I did, the places I lived, the challenges and joys of each assignment, but all my attempts to abbreviate that account either come up without any clarity or they pay attention to the wrong detail. So let me just give you a list of some of the things I did. If you want to ask me questions about what I did, the details, I'll be happy to check with you any Sunday after church. I served as an HPI seagoing cowboy, 105, taking about 160 heifers from New York City to Bremerhaven on my way to Europe. Then for 2 years in Europe, I interviewed hundreds of refugees for immigration from Germany. And for a brief period of several months, I served with a team of volunteers who were assisting Hungarian refugees who had left Hungary in that uprising in 1956-57. I managed material aid service in the business office of the Brethren Service in Germany for a couple of years, and on my return to the United States, I served as a half-time associate secretary in the National Service Board for Religious Objectors while I was studying at the American University School of International Service. And then later, we married, and with one child, we went overseas and went to Italy, again to those sheep bells, and directed a project there that was for hardcore refugees who had been stuck in the camps of Italy. Italy had a lot of unemployment at that time, and so foreigners were not given work permits. They were simply warehoused in refugee camps, The actor Don Murray, who had, was the country's objector and had worked in Naples, befriended some of these people and decided there's something ought to be done to get them out of camps. And so he started the project. Later, when he ran out of money and the drive to do it, the Brethren Service took over the project and we finished it off turning it over to the Brethren. Later, I served as an administrator of a clinic and 33-bed hospital at Castellar, Puerto Rico, which served about 25,000 people in a rural area in the mountains of central Puerto Rico. Part of the job was to turn that program over to the local community so they would run it. The chief said, we shouldn't be running health services for people so far away, they ought to do it for themselves. So we accomplished that task. The hospital, by the way, had been started in 1942 by some of the conscientious objectors who were doing that program called Civilian Public Service. After the Brethren no longer needed my services, I served for 4.5 years in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and that's where I first learned to know David and Jean Sack and their children. And World Vision, with whom I worked, did child sponsorship scheme, but they also assisted a children's hospital. And I served on the board of that hospital, which also are a funding program. Then later, still later, after we came back to the United States, I worked with a consortium of Protestant and Catholic mission setting agencies, development agencies, and parachurch agencies that were involved in development overseas. And I was, my area was an area including Pakistan on the west and Papua New Guinea on the east, about a dozen different countries where I went to help to work. I went out about once or twice a year to see the project, but the rest of the time was in correspondence and management of the project. I could go on in describing in further detail my frustrations, joys, the exceptional people I met, the depth of the problems faced by people, especially Christian minorities in many places. But I think more important is a few thoughts that I have about what I learned at this time. When I went to Germany, it was less than a decade after the war had come to an end, and the ruins were everywhere in all these cities, like a monument to the violence that had occurred in that area. And from refugees and Germans who I learned to know, I learned the rest of the horror of that story of people that moved around, pushed by the war. But our service was volunteer service. And as I came to realize, to think about what's happening, and in retrospect, I came to realize that doing a foot washing kind of service, that is a person-to-person kind of service, in which nobody has higher rank than the other, in fact, the servant is the servant, not the master of the situation. As we did this kind of service among people who were formerly labeled enemy, it was indeed a very powerful peace witness. Brethren actions assured that brethren words were not empty talk. They showed our commitment as peacemakers. Frankly, I cannot conceive of brethren peacemaking that does not involve brethren foot washing kind of service with our words of peace. They are so bound together that we almost need a single word to capture the whole concept. And looking to the future, I trust that brethren in the future will find a place for involvement in the stooping, serving, witnessing kind of overseas peacemaking in the next decade, and I find that they're adopting. And maybe they can learn some things by looking back to that period back there around World War II. The other thing that I want to share before closing is that the experience of repeatedly traveling between poor communities of Asia and the affluence of America across a decade convinced me that both poverty and wealth must be addressed in peacemaking. Peacemaking dare not simply be about teaching the poor to endure their suffering, nor about excusing selfish affluence. The poor can be empowered to take the lives beyond a level of mere survival. Though we may think we live modestly in a world of widening gap between rich and poor, we need contact with the poor. We need it, if only to recalibrate our judgment about ourselves. If peace-loving Christians do not see these needs, then who will? Such knowledge can help Reverend Peace witness find a message that speaks to the 21st century. An awareness of the needs and motivate us to be more effective. But my vision is that in the next decade, Brethren will find the work with some of the needier peoples on this earth. That we will reach beyond our comfort zone in the ways that we work and get out there into some of those needier places. And on Thursday, as I stuffed chicken thighs into cans at Christian Aid Ministries together with Kathleen and Bill and Charlie and Gary and Paul and other brothers from Maryland, Pennsylvania, I took a moment to sense the movement, the energy in that room, and it's amazing to be among brethren who are active in service. But then my thoughts turned again to what I was going to share this morning, and I long for that same kind of brethren concern and activity linked to the poorer people of the world. And people who have no link to those cans of chicken that we were creating there. I long for the chance for more people to understand the problems of the world poor and understand their point of view and their perspective. In our country, we have many safety nets. The world's poor have no safety net. They struggle daily to keep body and soul together. I long for brethren to experience how, with a bit of help, people and communities can reach toward their potential of feeding their families, keeping them healthy, getting education for their children so that children's future might be even better. I hope and pray that when the brethren plan for the next decade is finalized, brethren will have a 21st century vision and commitment to find new ways of serving and witnessing to our commitment to peace and peacemaking in a shrinking world.